Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money, but are your bills accurate? Well, it's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help you. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. So to save, visit HealthLock.com today. That's HealthLock.com today.
From Pushkin Industries, this is Deep Background, the show where we explore the stories behind the stories in the news. I'm Noah Feldman. For those of you who have been listening in recent weeks, you know that we have been very deep inside Corona. In fact, sometimes I think we don't talk about anything else. And from an ethical perspective, maybe that's correct. This is a pressing problem, people are dying, and we need to take that all extremely seriously. Yet it's also true that a little while ago, when I spoke to Dr. Lori Santos of Yale University, she advised me that maintaining routine and tradition is a powerful way of managing ourselves under these circumstances. Well, for a lot of us, the maintenance of routine includes the schedule of holidays. And with Passover and Easter coming, we have to make a decision of whether to ignore those holidays altogether or to celebrate them as appropriately as we can under our current straitened circumstances. Here at Deep Background, we don't celebrate holidays as a podcast, but we do try to maintain some sense of continuity. And so we thought it was appropriate to have an episode that did talk about Passover, but Passover with a little bit of a Corona twist. And what better way to think about Passover and Corona than to talk about the biblical plagues associated with the Exodus story? For those of you who need a little bit of a refresher on what exactly those plagues are, the traditional count starts with blood, frogs, lice, and goes on in a list until it culminates with hail, darkness, and the killing of the firstborn. If that rings a bell for you, you might enjoy the rest of this episode. I'm joined by Dr. Idan Dershowitz. He's a junior fellow at Harvard University's Society of Fellows. His academic work has appeared in JBL, VT, ZAW. Those are big journals in the Bible world, I promise you. Not to mention the New York Times. His forthcoming book on the redaction of the Hebrew Bible will be published by Moore Seebeck. And he's currently studying the composition history of the book of Deuteronomy. Idan is one of the most creative scholars thinking about the Bible today. And he's also very engaging at talking about it. Idan, thank you for joining me. I wanted to start by asking you about the biblical story of the plagues. We usually start by saying there are 10 plagues, but you think that that might be a misnomer.
Yeah. So the idea of 10 plagues appears first in rabbinic literature, and they count 10 events that are described in the biblical text in the book of Exodus. However, the decision to count those specific 10 events is a matter of interpretation and does not at all derive directly from the text. It's not even clear that the correct classification is plagues at all, as opposed to, say, miracles, signs, wonders, and so on.
Well, then where would you start if you wanted to tell the story of the signs or wonders? Because I take it that signs and wonders are words that the biblical story uses repeatedly rather than the word plague. So where would you start your list? And we now know they don't have to be 10 in your list. But where would you start with signs and wonders in the Exodus story?
I think a good place to start would probably be the story of a competition between Aaron, brother of Moses, and the Egyptian magicians, where Aaron takes his staff and casts it upon the ground, and it becomes a tanin, is the Hebrew word, which may be a crocodile. Some people think that it's a reference to a snake, but it turns magically into a living creature. And then there's a bit of a battle between the magical creature created by Aaron's staff and a magical creature created by the magicians. But that seems to be the beginning of a series of miracle competitions between Moses and Aaron and the Egyptians. And so that continues in exactly the same form with the miracle of blood in the Nile and in other bodies of water, the miracle of or what we call the plague of frogs. All of those are told in exactly the same sort of language and literary structure as that story of Aaron's staff.
You then talked about how the Egyptian magicians also perform others of these miracles. And there's a kind of face-off, as it were, between Moses and Aaron and what they're doing, and then what the Egyptian experts are doing, their magicians are doing. Can I ask you, seen in the light of sort of ancient Near Eastern practice or imagination or ideology, is there a reason to think that there would be some fame associated with the idea of Egypt's magicians?
That's a good question. I mean, there definitely was a very robust tradition of magic in Egypt. And we also know that there were interactions between magicians from different cultures. So sometimes we find spells that are actually transliterated from, in antiquity, from one language to another. So we do know that Egypt had a robust tradition of magicians, and we do know that there was contact between those magicians and magicians elsewhere in the ancient Near East.
What you're describing, by the way, it sounds to me is like the practice of what I like to call ancient plagiarism, right? That if I had a good hymn or poem or story in my civilization and you came from another civilization and you heard it, you would just copy that story or translate that story into your own civilization and maybe swap out some of the proper nouns of the gods or the kings or the heroes. And then boom, you'd have a fresh story of your own. The most famous example of this, of where stories make their way through different ancient civilizations, is the flood story, which occurs not only in the Bible, but in older sources, ancient Near Eastern, Mesopotamian sources as well. Do you happen to know off the top of your head whether there are plague stories in other ancient Near Eastern traditions, or is the biblical story sort of a one-off?
You definitely do have stories of plagues in the ancient Near East. In fact, there's also traditions of plagues having occurred in Egypt. So we have ancient Egyptian texts describing things like epidemics. The Nile turning to red is something that's described in some ancient Egyptian texts.
You're saying there is an ancient Egyptian text that has the story where the Nile turns red?
Yes, I'm quite sure that there are Egyptian traditions that are not entirely dissimilar.
So when one hears that there are some ancient Egyptian sources that talk about the Nile turning red, there are two ways to think about that, roughly speaking. One way is the way that a religious traditionalist apologist would. They would say, aha, you know, here we have some independent evidence that these events might have actually happened. And then there's the way that a historian or a literary scholar would approach it, which is to say, well, this is a trope that existed in the ancient world. And if you've got a good story, people like to tell that story to each other. And it's not so surprising that that story would have turned up in multiple different literary traditions. I suppose that approach might also leave open room for the possibility that there was some natural phenomenon that sometimes occurred in Egypt that led to the reddening of water. But if there is any natural explanation for that that's credible, I'm not aware of it.
Right. And there are various different phenomena that can lead to the reddening of waters, you know, from algae to clay deposits and all sorts of things like that. But clearly what's described in part of the biblical account where it says that it was accompanied by the water became undrinkable and all the fish died. I mean, that's a sort of very dramatic occurrence that doesn't necessarily align with the presence of algae. But back to your previous question about ancient Near Eastern texts talking about plagues, I mean, we have that even in the Bible. Moreover, you know, a really interesting text in that regard, I would say, is in Deuteronomy 28, where we have a whole series of curses. And those curses include a reference to an Egyptian disease of some sort. It says, Yakecha Adonai bishchin Mitzrayim. So may the Lord strike you with the Egyptian boils or something like that. And that's, in fact, one of the plagues described in Exodus. So that it's not only a mention in the Bible of a plague of some sort, but it's even associating this particular one with Egypt. And I don't think that it needs to be a reference specifically to the plagues as told in the narrative. It could just be a disease that's associated with Egypt, you know? Some people call the coronavirus the right, Chinese exactly. coronavirus.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's the Chinese virus of its era, the Egyptian boils.
Yeah.
We'll be back in just a moment.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Let's turn to some more of the concrete plagues now and see if we can come up with anything interesting about them. So the frogs. I've always been fascinated by the frogs. Essentially, all of the other plagues or miracles sound to me sort of vaguely plausible. You know, large number of locusts eating everything. That happens sometimes in the world. You know, pestilence, animals dying. That happens. Boils, definitely disgusting, and that happens. Even the darkness, which maybe doesn't exactly happen in the way that it's depicted in the biblical text, there are eclipses and you can imagine people extending from that. But the inundation of an entire country by frogs has always seemed to me a little weird and outlying. Do you have any insight into that? What's with the frogs?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that frogs taking over a whole country sounds relatively implausible, even as a once-in-a-millennium sort of event. I'm not an expert on ecology or on the habitat of frogs, but my understanding is that they're amphibians and don't like to be very far from the water at all. So assuming that all of Egypt didn't become marshland, I'm not sure how frogs could have survived in the city centers.
All right, well, we'll have to leave frogs then as a mystery for the moment. What about the plague that in Hebrew is called arov, and which usually gets translated in most English translations as a mixture of wild animals or something to that effect? The word literally means a mixture. If you think of the children's picture books of the plagues, you sort of imagine lions and tigers and other things walking around, which notably are never mentioned in the biblical text. What is this confusing plague probably meant to have been in the original context?
Yeah, so I mean, it's worth pointing out with the question of what it means literally. So as you say, the root ein resh bet of this word is something that sometimes has connotations of mixture, although that same root other times has different connotations. It's the root of the word west, and relatedly, the root associated with evening. And so it has various different meanings, that root. And in the case of this particular plague, some of the ancient translations suggest that this was some sort of insect, a fly. Perhaps not entirely dissimilar from the plague of what we call lice, or kinim in Hebrew.
Idan, let's fast forward to, as it were, the granddaddy of them all, the plague of the death of the firstborn, which is maybe the most, maybe, I don't know if it's the most corona appropriate, but it's certainly the one that involves the warning that people should not leave their homes until the day. And so there's a little bit of self-isolation going on at the family level. And it's also the one of the plagues that's most embedded in the story of actually the children of Israel getting up and leaving. Why do you think the firstborn are so much in play here? Why not just, you know, a plague that kills off all of your offspring? Or maybe it's about Pharaoh being the king. Any thoughts on the firstbornness aspect?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that there's, you know, something even more impressive about killing just the firstborn than, say, killing everyone. And if you're going to kill anyone, then killing the firstborn is really devastating. It really is, you know, appropriate as a climactic plague. In terms of the impact, I think that it at least feels, when I read it, like a particularly traumatic event. Part of that might be totally literary, in that it's a more expansive description than what we have, say, for frogs or lice. But there is something about both afflicting everyone and, like, proving the power, proving that this isn't just, you know, a pandemic, but something that can only be the hand of God, in the fact that it's just the firstborns who are afflicted. That really shows who's in charge.
Idan, I wonder if I could close by asking you a more personal question. And it's this. You know, you maintain a traditional Jewish practice. You know, you go to the synagogue, you perform the rituals, you keep the Sabbath. And you're also a brilliant and path-breaking Bible scholar who engages with the biblical narratives as historical artifacts. When you think about Passover, do you draw a line? Do you think, well, at the Passover Seder, I'll talk like a traditionalist? Or do you think, no, like, this is how I tell the story of the Passover? You know, the rabbis say, whoever says more about the telling of the Passover story deserves praise. Is it your view, for yourself at least, that telling more about the Passover story includes the kind of historical analysis that we were just doing?
For me personally, it does. These are the things that I enjoy. You know, I delight in, you know, reading the texts critically and thinking about the historical context and, you know, the actual historical events that may or may not be reflected in these texts and traditions. So I grew up, like my parents and grandparents, doing the Passover Seder every year. And it's extremely important to me and part of my heritage. But I do like to ask questions. And I, you know, that famously is one of the points of the Passover Seder, is to have, you know, the children ask questions. And I haven't grown out of that. And so every year I do like to think about the problems and the complications and the evolution of the different traditions and the multiplicity of traditions. In fact, you know, a wonderful thing is that, you know, one of the elements, one of the central elements of the Passover Seder is, you know, this sort of codified question asking. And so to me, these, you know, there are layers upon layers of questions. You know, the Passover Seder is designed to inspire questions. And even the questions that are being asked have questions that can be asked about them. And that's my favorite part of the Passover Seder.
Well, I appreciate it, Don, that you're giving us a version of the Passover Seder where it is the origin of your engagement with biblical criticism. So I appreciate that very much. I'm very grateful to you, Don, for joining me for our special Passover episode. I know you're working on some very big things, and with any luck, when those are published, we'll have you back to report on those other projects too. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Talking to Idan made me feel ready to try, in a limited sort of way, to re-engage some of that tradition and some of that ritual in the form of the Passover Seder. I hope it had that effect for you, whether you're celebrating Passover, Easter, or none of the above. Until the next time I talk to you, be careful, be safe, be well, and enjoy whatever holidays work for you. Deep Background is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. Our producer is Lydia Jean Cott, with research help from Zui Nguyen. Mastering is by Jason Gambrell and Martin Gonzalez. Our showrunner is Sophie McKibben. Our theme music is composed by Luis Guerra. Special thanks to the Pushkin Brass, Malcolm Gladwell, Jacob Weisberg, and Mia Lobel. I'm Noah Feldman. I also write a regular column for Bloomberg Opinion, which you can find at bloomberg.com/Feldman. To discover Bloomberg's original slate of podcasts, go to bloomberg.com/podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Noah R. Feldman. This is Deep Background.
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the unconventional awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry. And me, I'll be there too. Enter now at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.